This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Jim, thanks so much for joining me on A Community of Voices. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well, Vinny. Thank you.
Great. I'm so glad you're able to come on the show. So you were the Republican Attorney General in the state of Ohio, and you, in that role, you're also one of the lead prosecutors. So I'm curious, before you were Attorney General or towards the beginning of your career, what was your view on the death penalty?
You know, I actually was on the subcommittee in 1981 that wrote Ohio's death penalty law. I was a member of the state legislature at the time. And at the time, I supported the death penalty with several points in mind. Number one, I felt that the worst of the worst, the most heinous of criminals, were costly to the state to maintain them for 40, 50, 60 years in prison. And the state and the public would save money if we enacted the death penalty. I never felt any moral objection to the death penalty, where in a democracy, through the legislative process, a determination is made that the worst, the most heinous of criminals could be subject to death. I could accept that. And so with that in mind, I argued that this would be more cost effective for the state. And number two, it would be a deterrent to future crimes. Now, in reality, over the last 32 years since that law was passed, neither have been true. It is not cost effective at all. In fact, it costs more money to go forward with an execution than it does for life imprisonment without parole. And it is certainly not a deterrent. We see no deterrent factor at all in the death penalty. So it really brings you to the point where you strive to reconsider what your decision was at the time. And I've done that. If I were called upon to vote for a death penalty in Ohio again, I wouldn't vote for it. And I wouldn't, because it doesn't do what it says it would do. And it really is very, very costly. In some of our small counties, you won't see a death penalty indictment, even in the most heinous of criminal acts, because they can't afford it. That county can't afford the litigation that follows in a death penalty action. So, you know, there's not the even treatment that there should be, and there are some difficulties with it.
It's really amazing to me. I mean, a very stark 180 that you were able to turn in your views on the death penalty, going from, you know, a law and order type of view to a view of really questioning the death penalty. And through your book, False Justice, I think that, if it's my understanding, one of the cases that really changed your mind and really turned you was the case of Clarence Elkins. So could you maybe talk to me a little bit about what that case was about, what happened, and I guess how it really changed your mindset?
It was a remarkable experience for me, because it did really bring about a total change of mind as it relates to criminal justice and the effectiveness, the potential risk within the justice system of a wrongful conviction. I was actually in my office in September of 2005 when a call came in from a state legislator, very, very fine legislator, public official, who just started chatting and said, "I'm calling to make an introduction to the man who runs Ohio's Innocence Project. He's asked me to make that introduction. He is here in my hometown of Cincinnati at University of Cincinnati Law School. His name is Mark Godsey, and he has a case he needs to speak with the Attorney General about, and I promised to make the introduction." So he put Mark Godsey on the phone, and Mark started to explain the case of Clarence Elkins. And the more I heard, the more I felt, okay, this is unique. It's not usual for a state attorney general to get involved and begin investigating a case that's already been tried. All the appeals have gone forward. The man has been in prison for 7 or 8 years at this point. He was convicted of murdering his mother-in-law and raping his niece, a horrible, heinous crime. But it convinced me, the conversation and the information that Professor Godsey was telling me about, convinced me that I really was kind of duty-bound to look into it. I brought in some of our prosecutors within the staff of the Attorney General's office, and we all got together and kind of formed a little working group, began looking into it, looking into DNA that had been taken in the past, new DNA, arguments made in motions for new trial. And I would guess that over about a week, we became convinced that Clarence Elkins, based on DNA studies, was absolutely innocent of this crime. And so I kind of weighed in. It was an unusual time in my career as the Attorney General because I'd never thought that I was going to find myself taking the side of a convicted murderer sitting in an Ohio penitentiary prison, and I did. And ultimately, at the end of about 3 months of some debate, some additional DNA testing, some advocacy, we found the prosecutor eventually agreed. It took about 3 months. And at that point, he was released from prison. The court that had convicted him vacated the conviction, and he went forward. It was a remarkable experience because it was the awakening for me that wrongful conviction really does occur. And you'd never expect it to occur, but it really does.
How long had he been in prison, I guess, been on death row up to that point?
He was actually not. The jury did not sentence him to death. They sentenced him to 94 years in prison.
Wow.
Or something like that. I mean, actually not 94 years. It was like a minimum 56 years with all the counts, and he would have been 94 when he got out. And that would be before he would even be eligible for parole. He would be 94 years old. So obviously, it was truly a life sentence. And, you know, the more I looked at it, what was really remarkable is the evidence against him was so weak. It's amazing that the jury came back with a guilty verdict. And when I began looking at that and then looking at other cases subsequently, I realized more and more the system isn't perfect. But there are things we can do to make it better. And so that became the point of my advocacy. And it frankly became the point of false justice. These are things we can do to make it better. And the bottom line, and I believe me when I tell you, I've spent my life in public service. I've worked as a prosecutor. I've prosecuted major crimes. I've obviously been an elected official 12 years in elected state office, time in the state legislature. All of these things have taught me many things. But the thing that becomes the heart of my advocacy is that those who are honored to be selected to serve as public prosecutors everywhere in the country have to always remember their charge is to seek the truth, not just win the contest. And when they put that frame of reference first in their mind, we won't have the same measure of mistakes we do see today.
I'm so glad you brought that up because I think that I'm really glad I was able to speak with you because I think you're in a very unique position because as a politician, as a prosecutor, you know, you're able to come at the idea and you're able to deal with the death penalty in a very different way than a lot of people are. So when you look at different prosecutors, when you look at people getting life sentences, when you look at people getting the death penalty, I mean, one of the myths in your book is that wrongful convictions are caused by innocent human error. So I'm curious, is it all by human error or is there some, politicizing in it that would encourage someone to prosecute someone or find, have the public think that justice has been served?
Well, in reality, it's sometimes not innocent human error. Now, don't think for a moment that I would criticize every prosecutor.
Absolutely.
The prosecutors are really committed to justice. We know that. And they work very diligently with those goals in mind. But there are some prosecutors who have done things in order to win that really subvert justice. A very good example, last week, a court of inquiry in the state of Texas leveled charges and brought an indictment against a sitting judge who was 25 years ago the prosecuting attorney in the murder case of a man named Michael Morton. Now, this judge, Judge Ken Anderson, was the senior judge in that region, and he was brought up before a court of inquiry because it was demonstrated that at the time of Michael Morton's conviction as prosecuting attorney for the county, prosecutor Ken Anderson withheld exculpatory evidence that would have, if it were heard by a jury, likely caused Michael Morton not to be found guilty.
Wow.
And subsequently, he was found guilty. He spent 25 years in prison, and then he was cleared by DNA, and another individual was firmly identified through that DNA, and that other individual had committed a subsequent murder of a like kind 2 years after Michael Morton went to prison. In other words, that type of withholding of evidence not only wrongfully convicted Michael Morton, but it brought about the death of an individual 2 years later because the police did not investigate further. They thought they had their guy. Michael Morton was the husband of the murder victim. Yet he always proclaimed his innocence. Now he's been totally exonerated through DNA. The actual perpetrator found. His life has turned around, but that's 25 years in prison that he had to spend before that occurred.
That's amazing.
That's a remarkable story.
That really
one of
is
the most remarkable I've heard.
Yeah, absolutely. That's just an amazing story to hear.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jim Pietro, former Republican Attorney General of Ohio and the author of False Justice, Eight Myths That Convict the Innocent.
When you look at wrongful convictions, not just the death penalty, but you know, a variety of cases, how important is DNA in really trying to reconvince a jury or bring about an appeal that is successful? Are there other avenues that have been successful that you can take to
yes,
prove someone's
you
innocence?
Can, but without DNA, it's very difficult.
Sure.
You know, a jury's reached a verdict based on the evidence presented, and unless you have new evidence that totally controverts the theory of the original conviction, you don't really have much of a chance to get a conviction overturned. DNA is that you know, totally dispositive new evidence where it's available because of the certainty that comes with DNA proof. That's been, you know, the principal factor in exonerations. We now have 306 DNA exonerations initiated by the International Innocence Projects around the United States. And then if you look at the total exonerations that have occurred since 1990, there are 1,100. So 306 DNA, the others are not DNA, other factors involved, but again, they're very, very difficult. Really, DNA has changed everything.
So going forward, I looking at all of the issues that we've been discussing with the criminal justice, in the criminal justice system, in people getting wrongfully convicted, and specifically in the death penalty, do you see these as a partisan issue? I mean, is it a left-right, liberal-conservative, Republican-Democrat issue, or should it be more of a moral issue that everyone should really, you know, sit down and really think about? And I guess, how does that play out in the political sphere?
You know, it should never be a partisan issue, and it can be sometimes. I mean, there are those who would say that the Republicans like to be tougher on crime, but, you know, I would argue, and I'm proud to be a Republican, but I would always argue that Republicans have to understand that being tough on wrongful conviction is not the way to go. There's a real need to recognize that mistakes are made, that we as a society, as members of public bodies like legislatures, have a responsibility to undertake the steps that can assure more accuracy in convictions. I'll give you an example. In Ohio, I was pleased to join with the head of the Innocence Project several years ago, Mark Godsey, and this is after I left the Attorney General's office. I was in private law practice at the time. He and I went to the legislature and convinced them to pass what became Senate Bill 77, which included eyewitness reforms, requirements for the retention of bodily fluid evidence for future DNA testing, and other steps like recording custodial interrogations on a video camera or on a recording device, so you actually have a record of an interrogation. It's remarkable when you realize that of the false convictions, there have been confessions made by the perpetrator, and they were proved much later to have been totally innocent based on DNA, yet they'd confessed to the crimes. I was shocked to find that that could occur, but it does. And if you had certain things like a taped interrogation procedure, you'd be less likely to have a false confession, or at least you'd be able to try to affirm the accuracy of the confession and the process that was undertaken to get the confession. The other components of eyewitness identification really become one of the most remarkable things that I never really understood. I never knew this. An eyewitness is not good evidence. People think it is. Prosecutors have often said, well, you know, we can't lose. We've got an eyewitness. And very often they're right. If they have someone who witnessed the crimes and then identified the perpetrator, they believe they have good evidence. But people's memory is not what you think it is. Mm-hmm. And we learn more and more that eyewitnesses make terrible mistakes. It's not their fault. They don't know any better. Sometimes they're even driven by the police, who in a suggestive photo array review or in a suggestive lineup even foster the mistake. And so eyewitness reform would encourage two things. Number one, not looking at all pictures or all individuals who are possible suspects at one time, but looking at them individually, one at a time. Mm-hmm. That gives the witness a better opportunity to actually focus on whether or not this might be the real perpetrator.
Right.
And the other one is to actually have blind administration. The person who's administering the lineup or the review of suspects by photo is someone who doesn't know who the suspect is. So that it's an administrator who won't, through body language, perhaps give off signals they don't even tend to give off that might cause the witness to make a wrongful identification. So, you know, all of those things I think need to be taken into consideration when we look at the mistakes that are made in eyewitness identification. 75% of the 306 DNA exonerations I mentioned to you were convictions that were based largely on an eyewitness, and they were wrong. If we catalog, over the years, there's been a study that really looked at 10,000 cases and where eyewitnesses were used, and the error rate for the eyewitness is roughly 25%.
Wow.
Now, I would argue that a 25% error rate would suggest that that's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Unless the prosecutor has more than an eyewitness, he really shouldn't even bring an indictment. So, you know, we really need to reevaluate our criminal justice system, trial procedures, the type of evidence that can be meaningful and the type of evidence that can be potentially mistaken. And we need to understand where those mistakes can occur.
So I ask this question to a lot of my guests, and that's, if you had the power and you could wave that magic wand, I mean, we've talked about false confessions, you know, the problems with eyewitnesses and police lineups, and then the realities that DNA testing can do. But if you could wave that magic wand, what would be maybe the first or the most impactful change that you would like to see so people are not wrongfully convicted?
I mentioned those simple changes in eyewitness procedures.
Yeah.
That would have an enormous impact. There are experts who say, and these are experts, they're not perfect, but they're using a lot of data from wrongful convictions and other circumstances where they interpret where eyewitnesses, for example, made a mistake. And they would say it's a 20 to 25% error rate consistently, and the way you can improve that to no more than a 5% error rate, in other words, a 75% improvement in accuracy, is to actually have sequential viewing, one at a time, and have a blind administrator. If you do those things and you take great care in the procedures, you're going to find you're going to have a higher level of accuracy. You know, it's interesting. We were talking and giving a lecture and a program to all police officers, part of a training program, and we were talking about eyewitness. And several of them said, well, routinely in their eyewitness procedures, about 30% of the time, the witness selects one of the fillers who happens to be a police officer, because if they do a lineup and they need fillers to actually fill in with, right, you know, with the suspect, or if they have photos, they often have an array of photos of police officers, and those become the fillers. He said 30% of the time in our department, the witness picks the filler, and so we don't have an ID. Now, if the witness picked a filler that wasn't a police officer and happened to be someone who they picked up off the street or had been maybe was being held for another crime, they would charge that person with the crime because they have an eyewitness. Where it's a police officer, they immediately know that the police officer didn't commit this crime, so there was a mistake made. But even when the police acknowledge that there's a 30% opportunity, there's that 30% of the time in their own lineups, the witnesses are picking the police officer filler, they have to understand this is really very treacherous ground. It is not an exact science. People make mistakes. You need to have more evidence than just an eyewitness.
That's just amazing. Those numbers just astound me. I have one last question for you, and I want to go back to the death penalty.
Yes.
So Ohio is a very interesting state because it has a very active death row, and Ohio does execute a number of people. But at the same time, there's a very strong group and organizations and movement towards abolishing the death penalty in Ohio.
There is.
What do you think it will take, or do you see in the foreseeable future that Ohio will end up abolishing the death penalty?
You know, public polls have a lot to do with policy decisions. And I will tell you that the public polls in Ohio still show substantial public support for the death penalty. It would probably take a recognition that mistakes can occur, and if we are too quick to do the to undertake the death penalty, a mistake can occur. I don't see advocacy as changing it very quickly. I really don't.
Sure.
I've changed my mind because I know that mistakes occur. And I've actually had, you know, as Attorney General, you preside over the execution process. Generally, we had a special team that would work with me. We would have a direct line into the execution chamber. We would monitor by camera and by phone every step from the time that the person being executed leaves their cell. And I presided over 21 executions. And what evolved is that as I was completing my service as Attorney General, I began to have concerns about several cases where the individuals, they were convicted by a jury, but there was still kind of a lack of absolute certainty. Mm-hmm. I felt that before the state undertakes a death penalty, they have to have absolute certainty. And so I went to the new governor, who was of the other party, but I was out of office. And I spoke to him about this, got a message to him. And ultimately, I guess I argued in that case and in several others since that there has to be absolute certainty. The one thing Ohio never wants to have happen is what may have happened in other jurisdictions, and that is to execute someone who down the road is determined to have been innocent, especially now with DNA and other factors and a recognition mistakes occur. There has to be absolute certainty before you proceed with an execution.
That sounds great. Jim, it was a pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks for
coming on the show.
Thank you very much. It was good to be on your show. Thank you.
That was Jim Pietro, former Republican Attorney General of Ohio and the author of False Justice, 8 Myths That Convict the Innocent. Let me know what you thought of today's show by sending me an email at communityvoicesradio@gmail.com. You can also like us on Facebook or follow me on Twitter at @ACOVRadio. To listen to past episodes or to find out how you can support a community of voices, I invite you to visit my website at wslrcommunityvoices.blogspot.com. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join me next week. Until next time, Radio Land, I'm Vinny Canizzaro, and you're listening to A Community of Voices from WSLR 96.5 Sarasota and the Pacifica Radio Network.
hitting the button. And the time is about 6:59 p.m., Monday, May 13th, 2013. Stay tuned. Up next is tonight's broadcast of Hard Knock Radio here on KBOO Portland.
In celebration of Foster Care Awareness Month, KBOO Community Radio and Boys and Girls Aid present two screenings of the documentary From Place to Place. The film follows the lives of three teens as they age out of the foster care system and then try to change the system that failed them. Following the film, there will be a panel discussion with former foster children from Oregon. The screenings will take place in Portland, May 16th at the Q Center, 4115 North Mississippi, and May 23rd at the Oregon Foster Youth Connection Resource Center, 1209 Southeast Belmont. Again, that's two screenings of the film From Place to Place, May 16th and 23rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio and the Board of Directors for the Oregon Music Hall of Fame congratulates Aaron Reyes, Evan Carlson, Mayu Sato-Beckman, and Tatiana Hargraves for winning college scholarships from the Oregon Music Hall of Fame. These musicians will be performing at Jimmy Mack's in Portland, Oregon, on May 14th from 5:30 to 7:30. Following their presentation, the Mel Brown Septet will perform as part of Jimmy Mack's Partners in Jazz series. More information about these performers and the Oregon Music Hall of Fame Scholarship Program can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the page under Community Events.
What's up, fam? You're tuned to Hard Knock Radio here on the Pacifica Network. On today's program, we speak with Deacon recording artist NECA about her brand new CD titled Soul is Heavy. Also, we look at the state of Africa, a conversation you definitely don't want to miss. I'm Anita Johnson. All this and more ahead, but first, these news headlines.
KBOO Portland.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell.
1,127. That's the final death toll due to the collapse of a garment factory building in Bangladesh. The number of dead and injured makes the tragedy the worst disaster in the history of the garment industry. A global focus has been turned on Bangladesh and worker safety in that country since the incident 3 weeks ago, and reforms are already starting to take place. On Monday, the Bangladesh government announced workers would be allowed to form unions without prior permission from factory owners. Previously, workers could only form a union if a factory owner agreed to the request. The government is also making plans to raise the country's minimum wage for the garment industry. Since the collapse, 22 garment factories have been temporarily shuttered for safety and labor violations. Labor leaders are asking the president to keep his word when it comes to Social Security. Doug Cunningham reports.
When Barack Obama was running for president in 2008, he said that he would not cut Social Security. We want the president to remember what he said and not go back on his word.
U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders speaking at a rally protesting President Obama's proposed Social Security cuts. Sanders delivered 2 million petitions opposed to the cuts to the White House. AFL-CIO says Social Security cuts are unconscionable. SEIU President Mary Kay Henry says her union objects to Obama's proposals to cut Social Security and Medicare benefits. Social Security pays for itself and doesn't add to the national deficit or debt. Any future shortfalls can be eliminated by simply raising the income cap on Social Security taxes. No Social Security taxes paid right now on income above $113,000. Senator Sanders says Obama needs to keep his promise not to cut Social Security, and tens of millions of people must mobilize to stop the cuts.
To rally tens of millions of people who understand that in this country, the middle class working families are hurting and we're not going to balance the budget on their backs. Our job is to rally those people and give anybody in the Congress who believes in cutting these life important benefits, we're going to give them a political choice they can't refuse. And that is, if they vote to cut Social Security, they may well not be returning to Washington. Thank you all very much.
Concession workers at AT&T Park in San Francisco have authorized their union to call a strike. The workers are represented by Unite Here Local 2 and have been without a contract for 3 years. The park is home to the San Francisco Giants baseball team.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.